So we're currently in a park in North London. You can hear the birds in the background. I always love finding these green spaces. I'm on my way to visit Reza Pakravan at his home. 10 years ago, Reza quit his office job as a financial analyst, and since then he's been exploring the world and making films about his adventures. In 2019, he became the first person in modern history to travel the full length of Africa, from west to east, via the Sahel region, and he holds the Guinness World Record for crossing the Sahara Desert by bike. One of his main interests is embedding himself into remote communities and really getting an understanding of what issues the indigenous peoples he meets face. So I'm really interested to chat to him about this human element. Let's go say hi.
I'm Megan Hine, survival consultant on shows such as Man vs. Wild and Running Wild with Bear Grylls. This is The Power of Adventure, a podcast setting out to find out what adventure really means.
Hello?
Hi, is that Reza?
Yeah, it's Megan. Come in.
Yeah, hi. Thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
How are you?
Lovely to meet
hi.
You. Come
you
in.
Too. Thanks for having me. Well, thank you, Reza, for having us here in your home. I'm so excited about talking to you about, I think, because I see so many pictures, as a producer, I see so many pictures, like TV pictures, passing through show concepts, and the majority of them about conquering environments. They're about, you know, they might be about spending time with native peoples, but it's more about exploiting those peoples than actually embedding yourself in them and really understanding them. And I think that's what I find so refreshing about your work, is that you're fully embedding yourself into the cultural, political issues that these indigenous peoples face. Why is that so important to you?
Well, basically, I started my career as the same way that you describe. I wanted to conquer, and I wanted to be the first and the fastest to achieve feats, and be the first to cycle the longest distance and, you know, furthest distance in the shortest space of time. And I got to the stage that I really liked it. I really enjoyed it. I didn't have any expectation. I just really loved it, loved doing it. But at some point, everything just started blending into one, and I needed to do something different. And I started thinking of what can I add to my... what can I add? What's the definition of the 21st century explorer? And what can I add to this world? And because I'm coming from a filmmaking background, I thought, okay, this is I can go to places and highlight issues that are important and perhaps get overlooked by majority of the mainstream media.
That's fascinating, because you haven't always been a filmmaker, have you?
No, I haven't. I was born in a family of television. Obviously, my mom and dad were working in television. When I reached this stage that I had to make a decision about my life, I said, oh, I know better. You guys working like, you know, ridiculous hours for little money. I'm going to go to finance, and I'm going to earn tons of money. I'll prove you guys wrong. But that didn't last very long. So after a while, I decided to swap the comfortable chair of the office with an uncomfortable chair of the film school and bicycle saddle and being on the road.
Yeah, because I think I get so many emails from people who are in, you know, what maybe you'd consider like a mainstream job, and they're you know, they're in kind of this, they say it's like a dead end job, and they're stuck in the rat race, and they really want to make that career change. I mean, for you, was that a difficult step to make?
I would say for me it was a gradual step. I realized I either I can just resign my job tomorrow and just, you know, go around and do expeditions, and, you know, in a year time I'll be broke and back in a square one and I have to go and do the same job, or actually I start entering a new industry which is extremely competitive, which is extremely tough. Start taking baby steps, and first of all I use my holidays, then holidays tend to sabbatical, then I had to take, I don't know, 6 months off, you know, then use sort of a between jobs, and then I went contracting, and then gradually got to the stage that I had an income coming in from filmmaking and giving talks and various ways that adventurers and explorers making their money. So then I was ready to take that big step and leave the city and have this as my full-time career.
Well, at what point did you make that transition from going off on these expeditions into telling these stories of these indigenous peoples?
Well, basically, when I did my big journey from north to south length of the planet, and I was going as a...
Was that the Cap to
Cape? Cap to Cape, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll try to break the world record and started from northernmost point in Europe and finished in Cape Town. And I wanted to do it in the fastest time as possible.
And how far is that?
11,000 miles.
That's crazy. All on bicycle?
On bicycle. Yeah. And I finished it in 102 days. That record was broken by significant margin by a German guy, Jonas Deichmann, a few weeks ago. He shaved off about 20 days off the record.
Wow.
Yeah. Obviously, the technology has improved a lot. Bikes are much lighter, and obviously, he's really strong. But anyhow, we were, by the end of that journey, although I was really exhausted Of course, I've had this sensation of feeling of achievement, but towards the end of the journey, I was sick of telling my own story. I was sick of pointing a camera at myself and say, "Oh, I'm exhausted. I'm completely shattered," or "I'm suffering with malaria," or "I'm surviving in the middle of a desert with heat exhaustion. I'm just trying to hold this camera and just crawling on the road to find water." All these situations that I encountered, which has made a great documentary. That documentary sold in 15 countries around the world,
wow,
which I'm really
wow.
proud of. That was my first big thing. But I was towards the end, I was really sick of it. And I was thinking, I need to tell other people's story.
Yeah.
And I will be the chain connecting all these beautiful stories together.
So you've just finished documenting a trip across Africa, west to east, through the Sahel region. What was so important to you about that area and that story?
I went to Chad a couple of years ago to make a film for Oxfam. And then on the back of that, I spent some time traveling around Chad. And I came across so many interesting stories. I've seen the devastation around Chad and being the front line of climate change, battle with climate change and desertification, ruining lives and destroying communities. And when I came back and started looking into it more, I realized this part of the world is completely overlooked by media, especially English-speaking world. We don't hear stuff about the region like Mali, countries like Mali, Chad, Burkina Faso. These are completely off our media. So I decided to get there and tell those untold stories. For example, I wanted to answer questions of like how desertification has led to mass migration, while the mainstream media focuses on migrants in the Mediterranean Sea. I want to understand the reason for that migration. While the wars breaking out in the Sahel region, it's quite an unsafe place. People don't go there. Why is that? Because it's filled with terrorists. It's filled with different insurgency and terrorist organizations. And I wanted to see, where does that come from? What is the reason behind that? And you can link all of those things back to climate change and the desertification and its impact on the indigenous people who call Sahel their home.
Right.
Did it answer your question?
Yeah, no, it did. No, so the impact of climate change is actually causing the terrorism and the instability in that region. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. Around Lake Chad, it's a source of fresh water in the middle of the continent, literally right in the middle of the continent. And Lake Chad has shrunk to 95% of its original size.
Wow.
So it's only 5% of it left. And
is that the main water source for
main
that
water
area
source,
as well?
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got drought and things in the area as well.
Yep. And right. As the desert encroaching further every year, obviously the climate change and subsequent desertification has impacted the communities in that area. And this shrinkage has led to loss of pasture, communities finding it very difficult to fish, to feed themselves or feed their cattle or find water for their cattle. So they have to move from one side to another. And terrorist organizations like Boko Haram has taken advantage of this cycle of poverty and started recruiting people. So that has led to the rise of Boko Haram and insurgency and mass killing of loads of people. So that is, for example, rise of Boko Haram.
Right.
We have this similar scenario in Mali, for example.
Yeah.
As the desert coming further and further south, the communities who are living in the north of the Sahel, like Fulani nomads, are pushed, they're cattle herders, they're pushed further south in search for new pastures to feed their cattle. That means they have to go to the land of Dogon farmers, who their resources is already dwindling.
Right.
So that has caused the friction between the two communities that they lived together in peace for so many years. You see, all of these sort of things are linked. And our journalism these days is very fast journalism. The journalists go there from one troubled area, move to another troubled area. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to move from one story to another story. And the only way to do that, you have to go there and spend time with people.
Yeah. And so the catalyst for the destabilization of the area is coming from the desertification of that area. Is that what you're saying? So that's the start of the whole issue there.
Definitely, yeah. That's the main driver. That's something that actually started the whole thing.
And why has that happened? What's the reasons there for, you know, the land turning to desert?
So the reason behind this, I'm not a geologist, but it's a climate change.
Right.
Climate change fueling the desertification. And the desert is expanding further south. And that's, if you go around Sahel, there is water, but majority of the land is covered by sand. This wasn't the case 20 years ago. A layer of sand comes from the north, covers the fertile soil, and that soil become infertile and kills the trees and pastures. And
it's quite terrifying, isn't it? Because that is such a massive area of land, isn't it, that we're losing to climate change and to supporting human life. I mean, that, to embed yourself in that and see that firsthand, it must be incredibly amazing to see that. But does it have any sort of emotional impact on you?
Well, the first time I went to Chad, it really hit me in the face. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, especially the lack of development.
Yeah.
It's the least developed country in the world. And that didn't click before actually I got there.
Right.
You could hardly see any motorized vehicle. You know, mobile phone in Africa is widespread, but in Chad, I could hardly see any mobile phone around Lake Chad area. And you know, people walking around with a spear and bow and arrow. And I was really shocked to see all of that. It's like 5-6 hours flight away from the UK. That really hit me.
That is close to home, isn't it?
Yeah. It's not far away.
How, when you're telling these stories, so you're going out there and you're following, you know, following people's lives and their daily lives, and some of the things, because from these communities that you must be seeing, must be pretty horrendous. It's like, how, I mean, do you get involved in these stories, if these altercations between people, or do you let the story run?
Well, I'm just an observer,
and
my job is to, I have to translate that story, make it less complicated, and present it in a sort of a TV language. So for people who are not really familiar with the story, they can grasp it and understand what's going on. That's my job.
And is that very hard? Is that hard to disassociate the emotional side that wants to help people? Or is it you're able to separate that out much more, so you can just be an observer?
No, I just can't. No, it's very difficult to just be an observer.
Yeah.
I mean, in for example, I was in the Amazon. I was filming in the Amazon with the Munduruku tribe, whose land has come under severe threat. They're living in this protected area, but they're sitting on top of huge amount of gold. And gold miners, they try to get to their lands and steal their resources. although they're in protected areas. I got to Mundurucu, and then we had an amazing ritual of 48 hours. We spent in this incredible lake, and you know, it was absolutely beyond this world. You know, they were catching fish with a spear and painting their faces, and you know, the romanticizing romantic idea that you have in the Amazon, that was in, I experienced it in a pure form. So it was really emotional when that ritual finished, and you know, I could experience this sort of untouched nature and these incredible people who kept their tradition, you know, this in the face of ever-changing world. And when we got back, the call came through that the gold miners with the barge on the River Tapajós, which is their river, and they're searching for gold. Obviously, I jumped on the story and said, well, we have to document this. We got on a boat. We went to the barge, entered the barge, which is a massive one, with like gold miners. They're all armed. And at some point, I lost it. I couldn't, I mean, the indigenous guys were so soft in front of these gold miners.
You lost it with the gold miners?
Yeah. And you know, the gold miners were bullying these guys and telling them, yeah, we have a license, we have to be here, and this is our right. We are Brazilians, and you are Brazilians, and, you know, we have as much right as you have. You know, you're sitting on top of a huge amount of gold.
Yeah.
Well, here's 20 liters of fuel. Get this and bugger off. And I completely lost it there. And I started, and thank God my cameraman was catching it. And I started, you know, shouting back at the guy that, you know, you cannot do this to people. You know, these people are one of the kind, and, you know, you're exploiting the resources and all that kind of stuff. And I just, halfway through, the penny just dropped. Oh, you know where you are. These guys are armed, you know.
Wow! Yeah.
Yeah. That was a time that, you know, I emotionally got involved in, yeah, in such a story, and it's very difficult to not get involved.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, there must have been things on this journey where you were traveling across Africa, and you're talking about you know, filming terrorists and interacting with that. Were there any times when you felt that your life was in danger?
quite a few times. The first incident was I was filming illegal migrants were in Agadez.
Okay.
It's a town on the edge of the Sahara Desert. That's right. A gateway for the migrants on their way to Libya. 5 days of a treacherous journey on the back of a truck. You know, they put all these migrants on the back of a truck, send them to Libya. And during this journey, people die, and it's horrible. It's a horrible journey. And people are risking their lives to do it, to get to the Mediterranean Sea. So I was filming them, and all of a sudden, one of these smugglers came with AK-47 and said, "Get out of here right now, and I'm gonna pull the trigger right now. Get out of here." So we had no choice. We just had to put the camera down and just leave. Or second time, we arrived in a city in Niger, stone throw away from a border in Nigeria, and Boko Haram launched an attack, and they attacked the convoy of Medicine Sans Frontières about a mile away from us, and they burned it down and exploded the convoy, and then the UN staff told us to just leave right now, and so we had to hitchhike out of Difa.
Wow.
Yeah. Get ourselves out of the situation, because they were attacking from the south and we were escaping from the north towards Chad.
Yeah, and you had a network that you were able to get out.
Well, not a big network there.
Yeah.
That was the only place that no one wanted to take me there.
Right. Yeah.
So I felt incredibly vulnerable, and I felt really bad for my team, because I put their safety in jeopardy. We just had to leave, and found the local convoys. They were carrying onions, so we all sat on the back of the truck full of onions, put our gear on top, and then just left to our Chad.
How do you select a team to go into these places with you?
Personality is the first and foremost. I mean, the strength of character is something I'm looking for. Someone that doesn't break under pressure. A cameraman who can film when things go wrong. You know, everyone can shoot beautiful images, but, you know, if you have the nerve to hold the camera while the smuggler's pointing a gun at me, then you are my guy. You know, I have you. So I'm looking for that.
Yeah. And is it hard to find people?
It's very hard to find.
Yeah.
It's really, really difficult.
Well, how do you put that advert out there?
I normally ask my network. I mean, it's not something that you want to put out. Like, I'm making a series called The World's Most Dangerous Borders. Who wants to be on board?
Yeah, I mean, how do you manage a team dynamics in a scenario like that?
Well, that's a really good one. I mean, you get to places that, you know, people really losing it.
Yeah.
I'm sure you experienced that many times. And, you know, I mean, when things get difficult, especially on an expedition for a prolonged period of time, you know, friction starts and the cracks start to appear. You just have to be the leader.
Yeah.
And the quality of leadership is just put yourself out there first, ask the right questions, and be responsible about your actions. When shit hit the fans and, you know, things get very difficult, then your leadership skills are the ones that you get things, put things back together and, you know, bring the team together.
Yeah, and how do you develop that leadership? Is it, do you think it's something that's natural, or is it something that comes from practice?
I'm not a natural leader. I have to be very honest about it. It's experience.
Yeah.
I've done it so many times. So I put myself in those situations. I know how to get out of it, so I can make my team confident and comfortable, boost their confidence, make sure they are right, make sure I break down the problems for them. I'll give you an example. We spent 4 days in prison in Darfur.
What? No way.
We entered Sudan from Chad. I've been to Sudan twice before. Right. And this time was the first time I was entering Sudan from Darfur side. And we had special permission to enter through a huge amount of negotiation with the Sudanese government, fixes and all that kind of stuff. So finally, we got to the border with Sudan, and then we heard the news that the big dictator Omar al-Bashir got toppled, and Sudan is a complete shit show, and, you know, the riots in the streets of Khartoum, and it's all happening, kicking off. Security was on high alert, and we were arrested upon entry in Sudan. And they were suspicious to us that we want to report on human rights violations,
right?
Which wasn't our motive. We were there to see a tribe called Masalit, the army took us to the barracks, and then we were handed to the intelligence services. They put us in prison and interrogation for 4 days. And, you know, sitting in a little room, four of you, all being in each other's nose and all the time, it was a very difficult situation. And obviously I was the person responsible behind all of these, because I wanted to go to Sudan. I was leading a team, and this was completely unexpected.
Yeah. And how do you get out of a scenario like that? Because, I mean, I'm guessing you're responsible for your team, you know, and you're locked up.
You have to be very creative. So in that moment, obviously, everything is dark and, you know, your judgment is very sort of clouded. So you got to sort of put all the fears, all the elements that really clouding your judgment into one bubble and put them aside. That's my method. And then think of the solution. So there, for the first day, I was really annoyed. Second day, I was extremely angry because they didn't let us out. We tried to do everything to make them comfortable, but they weren't comfortable. Day three, the cracks started to appear. You know, people started blaming each other.
So cracks, you know, in your team?
My team, yeah.
Okay.
What are we doing this? You know, why are we here? You know, people started thinking, oh, maybe we should call the, you know, British Foreign Office or get a British embassy involved. Obviously, that was the last resort. There were other resources to tap into.
Right.
So I all of a sudden I remembered a few weeks ago in Niger, I interviewed UNHCR, head of UNHCR, about their work and migration and that kind of stuff. So I thought, okay, if I reach out to that woman, maybe they can call the UNHCR in Darfur and get us out of that situation. And that happened to be the best judgment call that I did, because I made that phone call. I asked for a mobile phone to be returned to me. I had to endure a very international, expensive phone call, called the lady on her mobile phone. She was in Rome. She went to the United Nations in Rome on a big conference, and she said, "Oh yeah, are you in trouble? Okay, I'm on your case." So she called the head of UNHCR in Sudan, and then they called Darfur, and day five, they put us on a plane from Darfur out to Khartoum, the capital, and we were out of the jail situation.
That's incredible. Towards the end of the interview, Reza mentioned that he had a shed out in the garden full of artifacts from his adventures. So he had to go and take a look.
Yep, this is my little work / studio.
This is where the magic happens. Wow, it's nice to be in a little glamping pod. Great. Do you ever find yourself sleeping out here when...
No, it doesn't happen.
No. And so do you collect knives? Because you've got a lot up here on the wall.
Yeah, I love knives. I don't collect normal knives. Whenever I go to the community so far away, normally come back with a knife.
It's actually an amazing thing to collect, isn't it? Because the knives are so central to,
their
to a
lives,
community, aren't they?
Yeah. So it's a very good
so
way
it's
to describe
part,
it.
It's part of their world that you're bringing back, isn't it?
True.
It's quite incredible.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Key to their survival.
So this is from... this is from Afar people.
What are we looking at here?
This is from a machete from the Afar people living in Ethiopia, in the hottest place in the world. So I spent a week with them in Danakil Depression, and Afarmans are very proud of the machete and the knives. And after a week with them, he gave me this as a present, and it was really touching. This is from the Vudabi tribe, nomadic cattle herders of Chad. These are the arrows. Unfortunately, when I took the bow as well, but in Paris airport, it got confiscated.
Oh no!
Yeah.
That's so mad, the bow, but not the arrows.
The bow was so long, so I had to take it to the cabin.
Yeah.
And I managed to make it to Paris, but didn't make it to London.
Oh, no.
But the arrows, they were checked in, so they managed to travel all the way. But look how intricate they are. Look at these two, so sharp.
That is amazing. And they're barbed as well, so that they don't come back out. So they stay in the in the animal, yeah. And is this a removable tip?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the end comes off. Often they come apart, don't they? So
exactly.
They get stuck in the animal.
You're an expert in arrows.
I have a slight fascination with the knives and arrows and
survival
bits
right
and pieces. Yeah. You had an amazing story about these people, about the way that the interactions between the men and women in the tribe, which is really unusual, and I've never heard this before.
They're the polygamists. So basically they are the last remaining nomadic cattle herders in true form, actually left on the planet.
Yeah.
They're called the Vudabis. That's the group of people. And they're moving from one pasture to another. And they live in isolated family bands, and they're constantly on the move. What's fascinating about this tribe is that they are sexually liberated. And that means that the married woman can take any man as sexual partner, whether that's for a brief affair or for a long relationship.
Right.
But if she decides to leave the family, she has to leave the children with the husband.
Okay, and why is that? Why has that tribe developed those practices?
The tradition was born in isolation and on the move.
Right.
Throughout century. So I really don't know the root of that tradition. Where does it go back to? But this is practice up to today.
I suppose it would have kept in new blood as well if the women were able to migrate between tribes.
That's an interesting way to look at it. Yes, basically they are, their blood is pure. They don't marry anyone else.
Right.
And as soon as they're born, they get lots of tattoos on their faces. So the Wahhabi people are very distinctive. You see them, you just immediately recognize them.
Yeah. And this is what you're going to film next, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, I can't wait to see this. So I get emails on a weekly basis from typically young people who are wanting to get into filmmaking. And, you know, I think you are the perfect person to answer this question. So for anybody aspiring to visit these areas and go and explore these stories more, I mean, do you have any key pieces of advice for that?
The first question is, why do they want to go and see those stories? Do they want to document, or do they just want to go and interact with those situations or meet those tribes or people? What is the reason behind it?
Okay, yeah. So if somebody has found a story and they want to follow the leads,
they want
that
to document,
story,
they make
so they
a
want
film,
to document
you mean?
The story, yeah,
yeah.
And tell the story of, say, an indigenous peoples somewhere out in the Amazon jungle, for example. I mean, what are the steps that you would take initially before you even put your boots on the ground?
Sure. I mean, preparation is everything. And understanding the protocols and the dynamic within that community. For example, what I really learned, you cannot just, you know, rock up at the indigenous land and take your camera out and just expect everyone to dance for you. That's not going to happen. You really need to earn people's trust, especially those people that are not really used to being filmed or seeing many foreign people. And you really want to be the fly on the wall to have a minimum amount of impact on those communities. So learn the protocol, do your research. There's no such thing as too much research. You have to do so much research. Go and meet the relevant people. Understand the community dynamics. Once you get on the ground, get the local guide. Understand, the local guide is a key to your success, and they are the one that can give you the all the background to the community dynamics. One of the biggest mistake of lots of explorers are like, oh yeah, we don't care about the local guides, we can find our way. But
yes,
those
yes.
local guides are the guys that actually lead you to success and enable you to get your story and come out with a minimum amount of impact.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, thank you so much for sharing this with us, because, you know, there's all these incredible stories out there in the world, and it needs more people like you telling those stories and making the world aware, so that, yeah, and with the end goal of hopefully making the world a better place. Thank you.
Hopefully. Thank you.
So we've just left Reza's place, and my goodness, what an incredibly fascinating individual. The fact that he's delving into these stories that aren't covered by mainstream media, I mean, literally putting his life on the line to get out there and tell these stories that need to be told, just blows my mind. And I feel truly honoured to have been able to spend, you know, several hours chatting to him. Adventure was a TBI production brought to you by Wilbur Smith, the 21st century master of adventure storytelling. Adventure enables self-discovery through direct experience or from the perspective of someone else. Find out more at wilbursmithbooks.com.